Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FSCom's latest Reg Bite. Top trends in audit findings, prevention is better than cure. So my name is Elaine Tai, and I'm the marketing manager in FSCom, and I'll be your host for today's webinar. So look, just to start off with some housekeeping, if you have any difficulties with audio or viewing the webinar, please refer to the confirmation email you would have received and follow the instructions there. If you're still having issues, feel free to private message me in the chat area below and we can pick it up there. Look, you've all joined the webinar in listen-only mode, which means you are muted on entry, but we would encourage you please to use the opportunity to ask questions via the chat form at the side, and I'll read them and them out then to our presenters. So the format of today's session will be Phil Creed, who I'll introduce in a minute, will lead with the overview in the presentation. And then at the end, we'll move to the panel discussion where we'll have FSCom Senior Manager Fred McDowell. You can see there, Fred, and Phil Creed answer some of your questions. So look, to keep you all alert and engaged, we're going to run a few polls throughout the webinar. So before I hand across to Phil, I'm going to launch the first poll. Hopefully I'll launch this properly. So look, there is the first poll up. What do you think is the most common finding in an audit? Please select one. SAR process, compliance monitoring plans, PEPs and sanctions, feelings and CDD process, or client risk assessment. So that is now being distributed. So please take a minute and answer that. So look, while you're taking the time to answer that, and I can see you're all voting away there, I'm going to introduce our presenter for this morning's session. So look, for those of you who do not know Phil is co-founder and director of FSCom, and he heads up the financial crime team. So look, I'm going to close the poll now, and without further ado, I'll hand the reins over to Phil. So Phil, good afternoon.
Thanks, Elaine. Good afternoon. It is the afternoon, isn't it? Good afternoon, everyone. Hopefully you are all safe and well, and you have a coffee in front of you or some sort of something to eat as well. Probably we're getting up to lunchtime. Today, the webinar, we're going to talk about some of the top trends that we see doing compliance audit, and particularly AML compliance audits. A number of firms choose to do compliance audits for a number of different reasons. Some because their banking partners want them to do it, which I'm sure is a lot of the people in this room. Some because it's good practice, and to be honest, it is good practice. And if you're an MLRO of a financial institution, it allows you to show to a regulator who comes in that you're doing everything that you need to do. And it almost gives you the beauty of an AML audit is it's a point in time. So as your firm grows, findings may change as expectations grow, but what it allows you to do is track your own progress. So if you do something on an annual basis, like an AML audit, you can see how the firm's sort of progressing on. I'm going to talk a little bit about like how we conduct an audit, because if you haven't had one with us or with somebody else, it may be sort of useful to understand the context before we go into sort of the top trends that we see. Elaine has delightfully put on a poll, and we'll come to ordering and what are the most common findings in an AML audit in a couple of slides time. So if you get the chance, please do answer the poll, and we'd be interested to see what everyone else thinks to what we actually see in practice. Now, to start sort of explaining how we undertake an AML audit and what are the core elements that you need to think about if you're having one. An audit for us really is like a three-stage process, or we call it a four-stage process. But It's normally done in a 4 week time frame. If I say sort of each stage is a week, week one is a policy and procedure review. We would ask the firm to give us to upload to like a secure shared drive all their policies and procedures in regards to AML. So any onboarding policies, AML manuals, we'd have a look at your training materials, so on and so forth. And the reason why we do that is that we want to understand what stage your business is at and it's sort of where your AML framework should be or compared to your peers. And we really want to know that whenever we're doing like our testing and things like that, that we are not learning as we go. We already know what it's like. Stage two would be, you can see there, operational models and systems. Like now we have a good understanding of what your policies and procedures look like. What we're doing is we're doing these virtually now, but we would have done them on site, is actually seeing it work live in play. So we would sit down, there's really three processes to this. There's testing, where we would test your CDD files, we'd test your PEPs and sanctions software, things like that. The sort of second stage is what we call side-by-side and walkthroughs. And what we're really trying to do is go through your entire customer journey from a financial crime perspective. So how do you onboard clients? If there's a PEPs sanctions hit, how do you discount those? How do you do transaction monitoring? My feeling is, if you're a fraudster or somebody's doing something untoward, you'll be able to get through CDD, like the amount of information there is on customer due diligence and how to do that. They're likely to get in through your front door. However, if you want to catch money launderers, which you know, in essence we all want, you know, to do, you're most likely to catch them in transaction monitoring. And that's having a really good risk assessment and really sort of understanding what the customer does. So we'll go through sort of how a client onboards, how you manage your transaction monitoring, any discounts, things like that, with the team that actually does it in your firm. And the last one, which is always the interesting one, is senior management interviews. So we'll tend to ask, you know, if you had a £250,000 budget, what would you spend your money on? That's always like a good place to start, because it's areas where every MLRO that we work with in an AML audit almost knows their own skeletons, if that makes sense. And those types of questions really, really eke that sort of stuff out. Nearly every audit will have findings. There's high impact findings, which for us is a clear sort of regulatory breach. And to give you an example, that could be your sanction screening software isn't working. That would mean that you'd be at risk for paying a sanctioned individual, which would breach regulations. Low impact findings are findings where you could be doing things better, but it's not necessarily a regulatory breach. If I'm going to think of one, it could be if I was going to stick with PEPs and sanctions, it could be your fuzzy logic isn't calibrated the way that we would expect. We would run a number of tests of different iterations on any name that's on the sanctions list or any name or that's a political person. We would do Emmanuel Macron as an example, and we would spell his name, you know, slightly different in different ways. We would expect your fuzzy logic to pick that up. And one of the things that comes out of the audits is fuzzy logic generally isn't a perfect science or isn't an exact science. What good practice is for fuzzy logic is really that you understand what the limitations of your fuzzy logic is. And you document that. We then have sort of industry best practice recommendations. So this is where this isn't necessarily a finding, but this could be areas that you we have seen in other firms that they do things slightly differently and you should consider doing. Really, that's to make your processes faster, better, quicker, things like that. And we will just give feedback throughout the audit from start to finish as we go through and as we notice things that maybe could be tweaked, could be better, whatever. Why is this year's audit different to last year's? Well, no two audits are ever the same. They are a point in time audit, so it's not an assessment of your entire previous years or your previous 2 years if you haven't had an audit for a while. It is, what is your AML controls like at this minute in time for the type of business that you are? Your findings can change year on year, and there's some common findings which we're coming up to next, but what we find working, we probably do 40 or 50 audits a year, and a number of those are the same clients that we see. As your firm grows, the expectations of your financial crime framework should also grow. So although you may have had findings from the year before that were relatively straightforward and you've remediated them, that is not a reason to suspect that if your firm has grown by another 30%, that we would then expect your financial crime controls to grow at a similar level. And there's an analogy later on which I'll use, which Fred loves because he's a racing driver, but it's about a racing car, and I'll come on to it later on. But expectations change as your firm grows, and I think that's an important point to bring out. So what are the most common findings? Elaine, I don't know if you've got the results of the poll there before we go on to this one.
Yes, they do indeed. I'll just share the results of that now. So results of that, what do you think is the most common finding in an audit? So we actually had then 50% say failings in CDD process being the most common finding. 30% then of people thought client risk assessments was the most common, and 20% compliance monitoring plans. So no one said SAR process or PEP sanctions. So I'll just hide that again now.
Okay, so the most common finding that clearly is no surprise to most of you is gaps in client CDD files. You'd be amazed how often we find gaps in CDD files, or it can be poor record keeping as well, you know, having things stuck on emails and actually not, whenever it comes back, and not being able to retrieve it. One of the things that we would always say is that a money laundering investigation by its nature takes years to come to fruition. So if one of your clients was involved in a money laundering investigation, you probably wouldn't have the enforcement officers coming to your door for 2 or 3 years after. And it's really, really important to make sure that your record keeping is tight and the notes that you make are clear, because you just won't remember looking back on the other side. The second most common finding is gaps in PEPs and sanctions screening alerts. A lot of the times, PEPs and sanctions screening alerts, there's backlogs, and it's important to keep on top of backlogs and set yourselves SLAs as to how to do that. And compliance monitoring plans are something that some firms of a certain size don't necessarily need to have if they're relatively small. It's something that you would expect to see become more and more sophisticated and mature as the firm becomes more sophisticated and mature, and it's really, really important that keeps up. SAR processes, this tends to be your SAR process isn't well documented, you're maybe not sending back notification to somebody who submitted a SAR that they've complied with their obligations, stuff like that, and the client risk assessment is number five, because most firms have a client risk assessment, so in terms it's never really a regulatory breach. However, some firms, their climate risk assessment can be quite basic, so it would be more in the lower risk area, but does come up a lot. We're going to sort of deep dive into each one of those so you can sort of think about how your firms work in this, because these are the most common areas of sort of financial crime framework weakness, and it's important to sort of highlight those areas because they would be the highest areas of risk as we would see it. So gaps in CDD files, sometimes there's no distinction between CDD and EDD, or sometimes people do EDD by going, right, we're going to verify four directors rather than two. One thing that, you know, I'd like to call out now is that the purpose of your AML framework is to catch the bad actors and not to discriminate out against the good actors. Now, in some occasions, verifying more directors or more beneficial shareholders is a benefit. A lot of occasions, that doesn't help you catch money laundering, and you should be looking for other sources of information, like source of funds, or why are you doing this transaction, or things like that. What we see a lot is backlogs and CDD refresh. Every firm that starts at a certain level and grows will have, you know, risk rated clients, high, medium, and low risk, and then maybe set their CDD refresh on 1 year for high risk, medium risk 2 years, low risk 3 years. What tends to happen is the firm shoots out of the blocks and signs up loads and loads of clients. And that, because that is a year down the line or 2 years down the line, firms don't really worry too much about that until they have to. And the problem is that when they have to, they don't have the resource in place and the processes and things like that to actually manage it. So a lot of firms are constantly playing catch up and CDD refresh, which is not good practice, because in order to combat money laundering, financial crime, you need to know who your customer is, and part of that is refreshing that KYC information. With the fourth money laundering directive, authorized signatories need to be verified. That's a very common finding right now, because actually that's a slight nuance difference. With the fourth money laundering directive, it was a bit more risk-based before, and now firms, their processes and things like that, if they haven't updated them, then they're not authorized signatories. One of the most interesting things in authorized signatories is actually defining what an authorized signatory is. We have some firms that have an authorized signatory that can add users. You know, there's a lot of these firms are online, and they can add sort of 20 or 30 actual users underneath their account. And in theory, they could be considered authorized signatories. However, if you have the right controls in place, i.e., you know, they can do the administration side, but maybe not make payments, then you wouldn't necessarily consider them an authorized signatory, and as such, you don't need to verify them. So actually, a key point that we would see come up now, and people who have given this due consideration, is they're actually defining who it is. So it could be the director or somebody that you're already verifying and saying, this is the authorized signatory, as we see it, and they can allocate responsibility down, but they are, you know, the responsibility lies with the authorized signatory, so that you do not need to verify all those people, which is definitely can be a bit of a headache for some firms. Again, the sort of last one there, there's no financial demographics. Not everyone can read finances, but it's important to understand what your client is doing, and to do that, you need to understand roughly what a P&L does and what balance sheets, what the information in balance sheets mean, because that is the only way that you can compare the activity for a limited company against the activity they do through you against their accounts, because you can tell if it makes sense or it doesn't make sense. Gaps in PEPSA sanction screening alert, fuzzy logic not calibrated well. It comes up time and time again. We would run 20 tests probably through fuzzy logic. You know, maybe 50% that's a hit, and there's a number there that you would think. Fuzzy logic really struggles below 4 characters. So you know, Paul Smith would be a really tricky one if there's a misspelling there, because it's less like, you know, it's less likely that a misspelling is going to occur. That's fine. And what we would ask firms to do is to actually just understand what their fuzzy logic does, run some tests and go, and it is a risk basis. There's not a defined way of saying that this is how your fuzzy logic should work. As such, if you have some sort of policy document or some sort of document that says we understand how it works and we're happy with the risk that's posed, then you're not going to get a finding on fuzzy logic. Dispositioning of alerts varies greatly from not a match or simply a no to a very detailed and exceptionally detailed disposition. What we mean by that is whenever you're discounting alerts, you need to have a reason why. Just saying that it doesn't match or whatever. Again, if we go back to money laundering investigation, if they came back and said, why did you discount this whenever it looks like it probably is? You need to know what, there is a reason. Do you know what I mean? You will have done a web search or something. So adding screenshots or adding at least notes as to why that decision's been done is good. It's good practice. Perhaps you're not always identified, so sometimes your databases are suspect. That happens again a lot, although they are getting better. You see ones now that don't necessarily rely on analysts. They use AI and machine learning and all that sort of good stuff to get them live very, very quickly, which is great. But sometimes they're not always identified. And you should test your PEPSA sanctions software. A lot of people, it's getting more and more prevalent that people do this, but certainly historically, people didn't test their PEPSA sanctions software. You know, they'd go to Thomson Reuters or Refinitiv, whatever they're called now, Dow Jones and Lexis, and just rely on the fact that they're a big name, that the regulator wouldn't come down on them. But actually, they will, and we have seen it. So it's important that you test it. Compliance monitoring. Some firms don't have any, and they should. It should be, you know, it depends on the size of the firm as to how sophisticated it needs to be. There can be out of date risk assessments. There's no independent checking. There's no recording of findings, and there's no like key oversight document. A good compliance monitoring plan for us has. It can cover like a range of stuff, not just financial crime, but has key testing, either monthly, quarterly, whatever, but also has output from that testing. Like there's a number of firms that we would know and deal with that do compliance monitoring plans and maybe do wholesale on other financial services firms who offer wholesale services. What can happen is that they maybe go out and visit the firm on site and do like some sort of audit, a bit like, you know, Barclays would do, or used to do, and some other financial services providers. But there's no output from that visit. You know, there's no report. There's no output to say I've done this, and this, and so there's no evidence to say that was any use. And certainly that's what we would expect to see. It's for SARS. We can see there's no SAR template, so sometimes it's just a flick of an email. There's no staff acknowledgement, so a return from the MRO saying thank you for your SAR, it'll be dealt with. You've complied with your regulations under POCA. Awareness level can be low, and what we mean by that is good SAR training should take into consideration sort your firm has actually taken, submitted, and gone through. I think, you know, if you want to get people engaged with SARS, particularly people who are not AML, is not sort of their primary focus of their day. Adding in, you know, particular SARS that the company has submitted and it has gone through, and show and replaying that back and explain why this transaction was suspicious is really, really good. And the NCA does a load of case studies as well. So if there's not something like that that's specific for your company, go on to the NCA and you'll be able to get a lot of case studies. And finally, the client risk assessment. As I mentioned, like most firms have it. It's not as if it doesn't exist. Many times it can be too high level. It is not specific to the product, to the type of person. You may have individuals, corporates, and they'll probably be different, but getting down in the nitty-gritty, it can be too high level, and we would see, yes, the client risk assessment exists, but it's a couple of questions. It can be very manual, and that wouldn't be our preference. Like, we would like to see automated risk scoring if possible. It can remove some inconsistency whenever people are filling these out, and bias. People have individual bias, and having an automated risk score that on a sophisticated model can reduce that. One thing that really bothers me with client risk assessments is the whole purpose of a client risk assessment is to focus your limited resources on the areas of highest risk for your business. So we would see, sometimes we would deal with a lot of wholesale providers and maybe offer other financial institutions payment rails or things like that. And they would just go, well, all of our clients are high risk. Of course they are, their financial institutions, their MSBs. That is not the purpose of a risk assessment. If all your clients are that, there's high risk and there's high risk. There's high risk and there's sort of slightly lower risk even in that industry type. So, and if I go back to the ethos of a client risk assessment, it is to focus your resources on the areas of highest risk to your business. So having all your clients high risk completely negates that. I think, you know, prevention is better than cure. And I think, you know, I'm not speaking out of turn to say that most firms would rather have FSCOM come in and have a look sort of in around your policies, procedures, and offer recommendations than the FCA. You need to keep your policies, procedures up to date. The procedures in particular need to be reflective of your operational model and how people are actually doing things in practice. If you do this regularly, or you look at it on an annual basis, which is becoming more and more good practice, it allows you as an MRO to have a defense. It's so long as the findings that are covered are picked up and remediated, but also hopefully should give you some sort of leverage to gain more resources if you need to do that, and does not allow problem areas to stack into a really, really big problem. So as such, can sort of lower the cost of doing this if you spread it over a number of years. Everyone has findings. It's what you do with those findings which is the most important thing. Now, this is where Fred will kill me, because there's a really good analogy that, like, a lot of firms start off relatively small and grow like mad. We would observe that many firms they start off with good policies and controls that are proportionate at their startup sort of stage. When the growth kicks in and volumes grow, revenue improves and the momentum is building, things are great. But I've coined a phrase called compliance debt, but what tends, which comes from tech debt, which is a developer's term, but what tends to happen is people focus on the sales, and don't necessarily work on the controls to manage that volume of business. I'm going to use Fred's story, but I apologize in advance. Like, there's a story that goes of a young racing enthusiast. He had always dreamed of doing some racing. He eventually took the plunge and bought his racing car, and away he went. All went well. Even in his first season, there was some success. Over the winter months, he decided, by the encouragement of the initial success, he upgraded his engine, giving him 30% more power. Excited, he looked forward to a second season. However, in the first few races, things did not go according to plan, and he ran off the track a few times and had a few near misses. He took a step back and pondered what had gone wrong with his car, but it was much faster and it was not performing as he wanted. He did not feel he had control of everything, and what he had forgotten to do was upgrade his brakes. So in that analogy, which is a racing car analogy, which is Fred done, is yes, you, as your sales grow and everything grows and everything go in the right direction, it's really important not to forget about the controls and the stuff that you need to have in place to make sure that that can keep going at a sustainable rate and make sure that this doesn't become a bigger issue than it needs to. Again, we would see a lot of CDD refresh backlogs, and that's almost classic of this. It is, you know, we're going to review and refresh all our clients on a high, medium, and low risk basis every year, 2 years, 3 years, and we're growing like mad for 3, 4, 5 years, and all of a sudden we have a backlog that is crazy, and it's going to take a serious amount of remediation. That is sort of a whistle-stop tour of our audit process and some of the key things that we think sort of firms should be thinking about as we're going through. Elaine, I think, has some questions of people who have been asking as we've been going through.
Yes, we've got plenty of questions here, Phil, and I think on that note we'll introduce into the panel session our race car driver, Fred. So Fred, if you can come on into the session there, I'll introduce you. So as well as being a race car driver, a motorbike biker, and I love that analogy, by the way, Fred is also a senior manager on the financial crime team at FSCom. And look, as such, he's well placed to answer some of your pressing questions, which, thank you, they're still coming in. So please, keep them coming, and look, we'll endeavour to answer as many as we can. Any that we don't get to, we will follow up with you afterwards. And look, a couple of people have been asking about the slides and the recording. You will receive the recording and the follow-up email tomorrow, but we'll also send the slides for those who want the slides as well. So look, right, that leads us in, as I say, to the panel session. So let's start with the questions that are coming in. So number one, let's see. What ML trends are you seeing for increased digital banking customers? So Phil, will we go to you for that one?
Sure, it's pretty much what I've said. With the new sort of startups and the focus on digital, what you tend to see with these firms is the focus is sales. They need to get customer numbers up in order to justify big valuations, to get some more money, to get more customers, and so on and so forth. What tends to happen is that the investment in compliance isn't at the same rate, and then you end up with this compliance debt, or, you know, the brakes aren't as good as the front end. That can cause a lot of challenges, particularly with KYC refreshes and sort of almost these things just get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Okay, Phil, thank you. Hopefully that answered that question. Now, number two, we'll go to you for this one, Fred, if that's okay. What are the differences in trends between Asia, Europe, and the US? What do you think are the differences in audit trends?
Okay, Lynn, thank you. In our experience, we've done audits across all those areas. And generally speaking, the findings don't differentiate. They're all very much the same. What you might find is a local regulator may have a particular sensitivity, or they might have had some very hefty fines in the immediate past. Therefore, when they would see a report, they might have more of a focus. But generally speaking, the five areas we covered off earlier would very much be common across all the geographies that we've done audits upon.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Fred. Phil, anything to add there? Or has he covered that one?
No, he's covered it. Yeah, like AML processes, they differ in minor ways between jurisdictions. What tends to be the major difference is the approach of the regulators, and so that they have some sort of bee in their bonnet, as it were, in particular. So no, 100% agree.
Great. Okay. Right. Move on then to the next question. So how do you think artificial intelligence is going to help in AML? Phil?
It should, you know, in theory. I'm still not convinced that artificial intelligence actually exists yet. It's probably just machine learning. You'll see a lot of new reg tech providers using these tools, you know, to better improve processes. I think the danger of artificial intelligence and machine learning is that there's a story from, I think it was Amazon or Google, where they used artificial intelligence to basically help them with their recruitment process. So they said, blah, 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 submit your CVs and so on and so forth. And it turned out that whenever they were interviewing, they were only interviewing sort of middle-aged white men, because middle-aged white men made the artificial intelligence. They actually, you know, so the bias was built into the code. So that's always the challenge with it. But hopefully, it's a technology well worth using, so long as it's used in the right way.
Okay, thanks, Phil. Okay, next question then. We'll go to Fred Orr, if that's okay, Fred. So when you're meeting new clients and kicking off a new audit, what do you then as an auditor think is the most important part of the process?
Okay, if they're new clients, and I'll also suppose that if they're repeat clients as well, as we would spend a lot of time initially looking at the scope of the audit. So rather than just assuming we're going to cover, you know, areas 1 to 10, we would always spend time with the client. That's probably critically important with a new client to understand exactly what they want in the audit. You know, what is the scope they want to cover? We would share with what we would see as a kind of very common and generic scope. Sometimes our banking partner will also have written them a specific scope. So we would always double check to make sure that we're covering all the points. If they're going to share their audit report, maybe with a banking partner or with Visa or MasterCard or somebody. Mm-hmm. And really it's to kind of personalize the audit. And sometimes also in that scope, firms will already maybe acknowledge themselves that they have certain weak points. For example, they may know their transaction monitoring system is 3 or 4 years old, and they may ask us to have a special focus in it, just to try and see what the recommendations would be in that area. The other big thing in audits, again, very important, you know, be it new clients or existing, is to spend that time to kind of build up a bit of rapport with them. We're obviously coming in, we're obviously not an external regulator. You know, they're paying us a fee to come in and do the audit. So really, the more open, the more transparent they are with us in that audit process, the better. And to try and build up that initial trust that they will, you know, they will be very, do it really in a true sense of a partnership with us, because that gives us a much, much better chance of giving them a good, accurate report that actually reflects their business. Those would be the two core things. And then the third thing is just when we touched upon what Phil said, you know, just keeping them regularly involved in the whole process. So at no point do they feel disengaged from it. They're very, very much part of the whole process as we go through an audit.
Okay, thank you for that. Thanks for that, Fred. Okay, another question then, Phil. So what type of audit issues have you seen in respect of safeguarding requirements in firms? Now, there's another question. Well, I think it's more or less the same one. Safeguarding is a hot topic with the FCA. What areas and audits have surfaced during your reviews is another related question to safeguarding.
Yeah. So safeguarding typically wouldn't fall under an AML audit, but we do audits for safeguarding, which I think we've got a webinar, and was it 2nd of July?
Yeah,
which will be done by the team that does that. Safeguarding is a massive topic at the minute. You know, we saw the FCA come out with some not very useful sort of information on it. It's always been a challenge. It's a particular challenge as to how to actually do it in a compliant way, as to whether the legislation actually fits that. But I know, is Alison doing it, Elaine?
She is. Yeah, she's doing it on the 2nd of July. Yeah, and then there's so, one obviously, sorry, just to interrupt, Phil, there's one also we're doing on the 18th of June through Compliance Ireland. So that would be an Ireland aligned safeguarding one as well on the 18th of June.
So I'd certainly recommend joining one of those. You know, Alison's would be up there with the top sort of thinkers and talkers on safeguarding, and I'd certainly recommend sort of joining one of those.
And she's also actually, and I'll maybe anybody interested in a white paper she actually has just drafted on the recent FCA guidance as well. I can certainly send that out to anybody that's interested in that. Okay, so next question then for Phil or Fred. If you are using a screening tool which provides company filling records, do you still have to obtain CRO records independently as well in Ireland?
I'll have a go this year. Depends on what it is and how much reliance you can put on it. So I'll give you an example, okay? Open Corporates is a really sort of cool system that you can use to pre-populate corporate data. And they only pull data from the CRO or whatever local registry office that is applicable. If you're using sort of big data providers like Bureau van Dijk, Dun & Bradstreet, whatever, you need to check the provenance of their data. Because in some occasions we've seen that data could be 3, 4, 5 years old, and if that's the case, then you can't rely upon it. It's really as simple as that.
Okay, thank you, Phil. Another one then here we have, maybe Fred want to take this one, or Phil. How do FSCom align their audit process with the current risks being faced by the industry as a whole? How do you align your audit process with the current risks being faced by the industry as a whole? What risks
It sort of depends on what risks, sort of maybe somebody's alluding to something in particular there, and you know, feel free to reach out to me separately. Like our audit develops as needs almost develop. You know, a lot of our audits are due to the banking providers' requirements, and that we would see like similar issues with firms who are at similar stages. So it develops, but it's very much a company basis. But if there's something in particular that person's alluding to, please feel free to reach out to it.
So, and Elaine, the other thing, just to just like many of the firms we do audit on, we would do horizon scanning. So we would look future to see what legislation is coming in place, and we would amend our own test programs, the likes of 5MLD. We obviously wouldn't have had a test in 2019 for it, but we would have a test in this year's program. And also we would look at fines, any adverse media that we would see, you know, where we'd see firms maybe getting fined for something. Again, we would see where there are systems controls that have broken down. And again, we would kind of build some of those more searching, more probing questions in their own test program. And again, we would see patterns and trends through doing audits. So obviously each audit is completely confidential, but on the other hand, if you see sort of systemic or industry failings in certain areas, you can also then inform yourself better to undertake the audit and actually go testing those too. So it is a bit of a moving feast. It's a combination of a lot of those things coming together to keep it kind of up to date and fresh for what's current as of now.
Okay, thank you, Fred. Another question then, it asks, how can you automate internal audit? Or can you? How can you automate internal audit?
You know, I don't know if you can. Like, you can obviously have a go at some of the tech stuff. So like the testing, you know, you can test your PIP sanctions in an automated way. For example, in the certain elements of an internal audit, you probably could automate. However, like Fred will attest to this, it's like a number of like the key findings that you would have doesn't necessarily come out of the testing. It would predominantly come out of like a walkthrough of processes and talking to the people who are actually doing these things day in and day out as to where sort of their main challenges lie. So I understand sort of the interest to automate an internal audit function. And certainly you could automate like management information, which a lot of firms would do, which can give you data to support sort of what's going on. But I wouldn't necessarily recommend automating the whole thing.
Just another wee point. I think automation in the industry is very, very common. Obviously, it's a hugely big drive for efficiencies. But I think the most important thing around automation is not what you do, it's what you automate. So ideally, what you want to automate is all the heavy lift stuff. But eventually, when you get to those key risks, like your clients who are high risk, your clients who you're doing enhanced monitoring on, I still think you always need the human eye on those things, because when you get that, you get a gut sense, you get the experience, you feel something's wrong. And I think automate a lot of the heavy stuff, yes, but when you want to get to the narrow edge of the wedge, in a sense, where the risk really is, I still think you need people who will intuitively think, well, that doesn't make sense. So I'm not sure, kind of what Phil said, I don't think you can automate the whole process.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both for that. This one is for Phil. Now, there's about three questions in the one. So I'm going to go through it all, and then I'll repeat the first bit again, if that's all right, Phil.
Yeah, sure.
How can you audit dual used goods on trade finance instruments in terms of sanctions? Okay. Then we have, what is the criteria for the dual used goods on an audit basis? And do you rely on what firms plug into their system, or do you have your own dual used lists? So to start off, now again, you might want to take this one offline because there's quite a lot in it. So let me see, I'll read that one again. Start. How can you audit dual used goods? I'm hoping you understand this question because I don't.
I'm sorry, I honestly don't. Maybe it's a case I need to talk to that person individually and see sort of what I kind of get the question, if that makes sense, but it maybe be better to understand the context a bit further.
Yeah, I'll take that one offline then for afterwards. So we will follow up on that one, just let that person know. Okay, are you seeing any other AML themes across digital assets specifically that deviate from banking? Or EMIs or PIs, such as issues relating to transaction monitoring for crypto addresses, for example, or too much heavily reliance on technology. So are you seeing any other AML themes across digital assets?
Yes. There's a lot of chat right now about privacy coins. And you know, obviously by their nature, it's like Monero, Zcash, and things like that. So obviously, almost by their name, you can understand that people are using them to have an element of anonymity. involved in their transactions. So there's a few firms in crypto world who are trying to understand what those risks are. In general terms, crypto gets a bad rep, right? People generally think sort of it's for money launderers and drug dealers and things like that. There is an element of that, but one of the really cool things, we do quite a lot of work with chain analysis and also Elliptic, is the investigation tools that they have. And it means that you can follow transactions, you know, not just from where it came from and where it's going to, but further than that, where it come from, and again and again and again. And it can actually give you a really cool sort of, you know, if you pointed it at one of the big crypto exchanges, it would say, yeah, 2% of this activity has come from dark web activity. So in a way, it's more traceable than cash. So I think it does have a bad rep, maybe slightly justified, and certainly things like privacy coins, which aren't getting traced by these firms, don't help that. Those are the types of things that we're seeing with cryptocurrency firms at the minute. It's, you know, a particular interest in privacy coins.
Okay. Thank you. Another one here now. I'm not sure if this is the safeguarding consultation that might be alluding to here, but I'll ask the question anyway. What do we expect the FCA consultation to result in? Will they start to visit and audit more fintechs? What do fintechs need to expect and prepare for? Now, I assume is that the safeguarding consultation they're referring to there?
I'm not sure what consultation it could be. It could be the safeguarding one, but to answer your question, they are auditing fintechs now. They've done it a few times, and they have a special team to do it. So you need to make sure that your house is in order. One of the key things that you should be looking at is, if you've had someone like us do an audit on you, the key is not what the findings are. Everyone has findings. The key is making sure that you action activity against those findings, and you try and remediate those. What is a big sort of no-no to your regulator is that you've known about this for 2, 3, 4 years, and it is still creeping up on audit reports. They would see that as a sign of bad culture, of getting these things done. And again, if we go back to the ethos of firms that are growing very, very quickly, actually the turnover of staff can be quite quick, because as the firm, somebody who's a compliance officer in a startup might not be as good a compliance officer in a scale-up and is not as good a compliance officer in a mature company. So the actual people tend to change a bit, which means some of these things can drop off the radar, which if the FCA come in and see that, they're not going to be best pleased.
Okay. Look, that brings us up. No, sorry. One last one. One last question. I think then we'll wrap it up, just looking at time. Have you had any feedback you can share from audit reports shared with the CBI, the Central Bank of Ireland? So have you had any feedback you can share from audit reports shared with the CBI?
No. does that help? No, we're not allowed to share specifics like that, so no.
Okay. Like, I think that's us. I think we covered all the questions that people asked. So thank you everybody for your participation and engagement. We really do appreciate it. We did have another poll, but to be honest, it was answered in the course of the presentation and the questions. So we won't be doing that one. Look, thank you, Phil and Fred. Thanks so much for your words of wisdom. And hopefully everybody find it all of use and have some key takeaways. Thank you everyone for your attention, your participation. As I said, the recording will be available in the follow-up email, And if you have any further questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to Phil or Fred or myself, and we'll endeavour to answer those questions. So look, everyone have a lovely afternoon, and thanks again. And all the very best.
Thanks for joining, everyone.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.